And straight on now to Mr. Harvey.
Thanks very much for the invitation. I'm going to move this down a wee bit because you may spot that I'm not quite as tall as the other chaps. It's not as bad as when I spoke at the Police Federation conference, I'll give it that. The lectern was up to there against me. I'd like to thank you for the invitation to come along and speak tonight. It's quite right that, as Peter said, reasonable people can reasonably disagree. And this debate, we should all probably recognise, hasn't had very much of that reasonable language. And so it's a good opportunity, I think, to debate the issues, to hear from both sides, and to try and maintain that reasonable, constructive, respectful disagreement. Why is the debate so polarised? I think perhaps we should recognise that part of the reason why the debate has been so polarised is that people do come to this issue from, let's face it, fundamentally different worldviews. Fundamentally different worldviews about what it is to be human, about what life is all about the source of our understanding of what's right and wrong in life. Now, we're probably unlikely to resolve those fundamental disagreements tonight. We're probably unlikely to resolve those fundamental disagreements over the course of the next year or so as the Scottish Parliament considers legislation. We don't really need to resolve those fundamental disagreements if we take the view of religious freedom. And that's one of the arguments that people can take as a starting point. Religious freedom. And Peter also suggested that religious freedom might come under attack. Well, what religious freedom? There isn't any religious freedom on this issue yet. There isn't any. As a secular legislator, as a member of Parliament in Scotland, member of the Scottish Parliament, I have to acknowledge that the law, the secular law, the civil law, is telling religious believers and religious organisations what they can and can't do. If you believe in religious freedom, and if that's the principle that you start from, it has to mean the freedom to say yes to same-sex couples as well as the freedom to say no. And there are religious bodies, individual religious celebrants, and religious believers in same-sex relationships who want to exercise their religious freedom, and at the moment the law forbids them. That's not the business of the secular law. That's not the business of a parliament to say that people can't do that. If you take this argument from the point of religious freedom, and you understand that that has to mean the freedom to say yes as well as the freedom to say no, then we have to have legislation that permits but does not compel. Now, personally, I'm not religious. I'm probably one of those secular, aggressive atheists that you hear so much about these days. I take as my starting point LGBT equality, the equal dignity and worth of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and the relationships that they have. That's my starting point. It's pretty hard for someone who's single and bisexual not to take that as a starting point. I don't count the chromosomes of who my next partner might be. If I have a relationship in the future, I don't know if I will or not, but if I do, it doesn't matter to me fundamentally whether they're a man or a woman. Why should it matter to the law? And so it's pretty hard for me to not take as my starting point LGBT equality. And I've been volunteering, campaigning, and at times working in a professional capacity on LGBT issues for the best part of 20 years. Whether as a student activist, a sexual health worker, a politician, or in other capacities. And honestly, I am yet to hear a coherent moral argument that says people in same-sex relationships are doing anything wrong. I've heard scriptural arguments, I've heard religious arguments, and it's been acknowledged by the speakers here that that's not what tonight's meeting is about, because obviously we live in a society now that doesn't impose religious ideas on people who don't choose to subscribe to religion. I've heard old-fashioned arguments of just plain, you know, common or garden play school prejudice. And hopefully we can all acknowledge that that's not what this meeting is about tonight either. Those kind of arguments do exist. I've not heard a coherent moral argument that says to have a relationship with someone of the same sex is to do something wrong. I've heard the argument, and we heard it again from Peter, that this is about children, that this is that marriage as an institution must be defended because it's the best place in which to raise children, the best context in which to raise children. The decision about whether same-sex couples can marry or not has got nothing to do with who brings up children. If a same-sex couple is raising children, what difference does it make whether they have a civil partnership or a marriage? They don't become gayer parents because they've been married. Now, I reject the argument that same-sex couples can't make completely decent, loving, wonderful, committed parents, just as mixed-sex couples can. Same-sex couples can fail to achieve that just as mixed-sex couples can. So I don't accept the argument that we should judge poorly same-sex couples as parents. But there's certainly no case for saying that allowing them to marry in somehow makes them more gay parents. Even if you think that there's something wrong with gay couples being parents, it doesn't make any difference whether they're married or civil partners. You might think it makes a difference if they are in a legal relationship or simply cohabiting. You might think that makes a difference. But I think it only makes a difference to them and the way that they feel affirmed and respected by the society of which they are a part. It doesn't affect the decision about whether they might raise children together or not, whether they have a biological link to those children or not. And let's reflect as well that the range and diversity of relationships between children and the people who raise them exists within mixed-sex couples as well, including among married couples. I've heard the argument that marriage must have as its prerequisite the possibility of children. That's a fundamental part of what it means. But it isn't. If I did happen to fall into conversation with somebody in the audience here tonight and fell in love and in a few months' time, you know, made a life together and got married to a woman, but bisexuals, it is a possibility. I have no intention of having children. I'm not interested in having children. Does that mean that I shouldn't be allowed to get married? Of course not. The possibility or the intention to have children is not a prerequisite for marriage for mixed-sex couples, nor should it be for same-sex couples. Now, I've had the argument that we'll be forced to conduct same-sex marriages. We'll be forced to. That people will whip up this fear that churches will be taken to court, ministers will be put in jail, I've even heard it suggested. It's simply not true. And beyond my assertion that it's simply not true, it's a technical argument. It only requires a technical solution. If your objection to legislation to allow same-sex marriage is that the religious freedom of those who wish to say no will not be protected, then all you need to do is wait and see what those protections look like. It's a technical argument and only requires a technical solution. It's not a principled argument. And then I've heard these bizarre and, to me, spurious suggestions that if we allow same-sex marriage, well, incest and polygamy will be next. The only thing being proposed in the Scottish Parliament is to remove the legal impediment to same-sex marriage and to allow the religious celebration, both of those marriages, and of civil partnership. There is no other proposal on the table. I personally doubt you could come up with a straightforward legal version of marriage that actually worked for the diversity of multi-partner relationships that are out there. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all legal model that you could apply fairly and in full respect of everybody's equality and human rights, even if the desire was there. But I've never heard the desire suggested. Most multi-partner relationships, polygamous or polyamorous relationships, are mixed-sex relationships anyway. They're mixed-sex relationships. And so to link this to a discussion about same-sex relationships is quite odd to me. It does seem to be a sidetrack, and it doesn't produce a meaningful, coherent, moral argument that explains to a same-sex couple why they may not marry. It takes the argument into a sidetrack. Now, I'll close simply by reflecting on how I came to be involved both with these issues and with the Scottish Parliament. During the first session of the Scottish Parliament, I was a youth worker in a lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth group. I worked for a gay men's project in an HIV agency in Glasgow. And I was profoundly aware of the impact that the Section 28 debate had on the young people who were going along to that youth group. They were going along to that youth group because there wasn't anything else for them. There wasn't any other youth service, any other part of their school or home life in some of their cases, that respected their right to be who they were and to be honest about it and to be supported. And I was aware of young people who were coming into that youth group on a Tuesday night telling me that the phrase, protect our children and keep the clause, was being used as a homophobic taunt in schools. The degree of homophobia that young LGBT people are growing up with in this society is often unacknowledged. It's certainly not combated in the way that we expect racism and religious prejudice to be taken seriously in schools. And for a parliament, a secular parliament, the civil authority, which we're elected to by all people, including LGBT people, to reject a law that says your relationships are as good as those of your neighbor is not acceptable to me if we want to respect those young people who'll be growing up tomorrow and the year after and in 10 and 20 and 30 years' time in Scotland. I want them to grow up in a society that fully respects them and the relationships they have, and supporting this legislation is the way to do it. Thank you very much.
And finally, for this part of the evening, Mr. Robertson.
Well, I was really nervous about coming here, but my night's been made already because Patrick Harvey has admitted in public that he's a fundamentalist. And that's really cheered me up. I would like to thank Willie Rennie and Patrick Harvey for coming here. Alex Salmond, Joanne Lamont, and Ruth Davidson do not seem keen to discuss this, which, given it is such a major change, is actually quite incredible. So I'm very grateful to both these gentlemen. I do want this debate to be a rational debate based upon logic, facts, and beliefs, and conducted with respect. I'd say, can that go for the questions as well? I always dread in these occasions a friendly question sometimes. I prefer antagonistic ones. So if you're from the Glasgow atheist group, then please feel free to take your opportunity. Alan Duncan, the first Conservative MP to come out as gay and is currently in a civil partnership, is opposed to gay marriage, as is David Starkey, the gay historian. The Labour MP Ben Bradshaw, who is also gay, states, "This isn't a priority for the gay community, which has already won equal rights with civil partnerships. This is pure politics." Out of a poll of 550 gay men and women, only 40% identified gay marriage as a priority. The only reason I state that is, please don't call people homophobes just because they don't agree with gay marriage. The trouble for me is that so many people are being given the impression that there really is no debate. It's just simply about equality and about being fair. I have a friend who regularly speaks on panels such as Question Time, and he says that there is no point in discussing this because if you go against the perceived wisdom, you are immediately regarded as some kind of right-wing moronic idiot, and shouted down. In that sense, it is true that the debate has been stifled. It has also been stifled because of the lack of discussion and debate in the press. The Scottish Government's consultation, like the British Government's, was a complete waste of time and money, with any opinions not in line with the already declared result predestined to be discarded. And believe you me, I don't want to get to a stage where we are conducted in government by politicians who take opinion polls such as the British Social Attitude Survey of 3,000 selected people, and then say it's that on which we base policy. I do not regard that as democracy. 96% of the articles published in Scotland's main newspapers have been in support of same-sex marriage, and I've yet to hear the BBC or any of the other mainstream media actually allow the alternative point of view to be put across in anything more than a cursory fashion. The result is that the current cultural zeitgeist means that anyone opposed to same-sex marriage is regarded as a reactionary, illiberal, religious bigot who deserves nothing but contempt and scorn. I do want to present the other side of the case. I believe there's been a core change of attitude in society in the past couple of decades. I like reading, and I like reading widely. In reading some LGBT works a number of years ago, I came across something that is called queer theory. And that is not meant as a derogatory term, that's how the literature styles itself. In general, those who advocated queer theory tended to be against marriage, full stop. It was considered patriarchal and paternalistic, part of the problem, not part of the solution. Peter Tatchell, in an article written 10 years ago, stated this, criticizing those who were for gay marriage, gay activists. He said, there were no calls for equality. Our demand was liberation. We wanted to change society, not conform to it. Our radical, idealistic vision involved creating a new sexual democracy. Without homophobia and misogyny, erotic shame and guilt would be banished, together with compulsory monogamy, gender roles, and the nuclear family. There would be sexual freedom and human rights for everyone, gay and straight. Our message was innovate, don't assimilate. I actually like Peter Tatchell. He's one of these guys who speaks the truth and is prepared to be really unpopular when the truth doesn't work for him. Has he changed his mind? Is he now playing politics? I don't think so. I think society has changed. I think Tatchell has got it right. He realizes that redefining marriage will destroy marriage. He realizes that this is the way to get rid of compulsory monogamy, gender roles, and the nuclear family. In a nutshell, Peter Tatchell has summed up our case as to why we are opposed to same-sex marriage, because ultimately it undermines and destroys marriage. Now let me get rid of one myth. This is not about equal marriage for homosexuals. It is, as David Cameron stated, about redefining marriage for everyone. You cannot have equal marriage for some without redefining marriage for everyone. My concern is not with the question of legal partnerships between people, whether heterosexual or homosexual. It is with the protection of that most basic of institutions, which has in general served our society well for all of its existence. I'm not concerned for the church. I never have any intention of the church anyway doing what the government tells us to do. If it's Christ or the state, forget it. Christ comes first. I'm not concerned. I am concerned for the poor. I'm concerned that we can have an equality network that has no concern for the phenomenal economic injustices in our society, but regard this as a major issue. I'm concerned that the rich can call themselves liberal and open and generous and for equality just by focusing on sexuality and ignoring economic injustice. Furthermore, I do not accept that a government can redefine marriage any more than it can by state fiat make the world flat. It's my view that there has been no serious thought, study, or investigation into the consequences of the state taking the right to itself to redefine marriage. The whole argument has been conducted on a purely emotional and irrational basis. I believe that if the state decides to, it has the capacity to redefine marriage now, what is to stop it further redefining marriage in the future? Who says it will end here, and why should we believe them? In Spain, for example, on official forms now, instead of mother and father, you're not allowed to use that. It's progenitor A and progenitor B. My wife and I were having a discussion about which one we would be. She won. Given the criteria given by Lynn Featherstone, David Cameron, and numerous other politicians, that marriage should be allowed between adults who love one another, and I quote from an MSP who said the following, "As I have said before, I believe that love is the same for all couples, so civil marriage should be open to everyone. Therefore, I recently signed the Coalition for Equal Marriage petition." That MSP should know that there's no such thing as civil marriage or religious marriage. There is only marriage. It's a new definition that's being brought in the confusion. And given his criteria, why should a man not be allowed to marry his adult son or two sisters married? When this argument is presented, it is met by a storm of ridicule. Don't be such an extremist. No one is arguing for that. And yet this week alone, I have a stack full of emails from young people saying, yeah, what's your problem? If they love one another, what's the difficulty? I think also that there are consequences for civil and religious liberties. Our politicians, when confronted with this, just simply say, "Trust us, that won't happen." Forgive me for saying this, but their words are meaningless. Even if we could trust politicians of the present to be bound by their own words, like "we will not introduce student fees or increase them," they cannot bind the politicians of the future. Besides which, the pressure is already being applied. No politician, journalist, social worker, or educator who speaks out in favor of traditional marriage can consider his or her career safe. Several politicians from all the mainstream parties have spoken to me in support of our stance, but on condition that I cannot name them, because the new moral thought police of our society would ensure their careers are over. Once same-sex marriage becomes law, you will find that the largely government-funded gay rights lobby will find other causes to spend their energies and our money on. Coming soon to a court near you, teachers accused of homophobia for refusing to teach same-sex marriage in schools, and churches having charitable status removed for not going along with our state-sponsored morality, committing the ultimate sin, blasphemy against the holy state. In case you think that this is fantasy, in the remaining time I have left, and I'm sure the convener, the chairman, will warn me when I'm finished, let me give you some examples. Gordon Wilson, my colleague, former SNP head, when we published the SOLAS document on same-sex marriage, within a week, the Dundee Voluntary Association, of which he was chairperson, had an extraordinary meeting and people turned up with proxy votes and he was voted off for being homophobic. Ian Luke, the Labour MP, resigned in protest. A social work student told me he'd been called in by his course tutor and told he would fail unless he repented of his homophobia because of a Facebook post that he'd said he was against same-sex marriage. There's a housing manager in Manchester who was deducted 40% of his pay for writing on Facebook that gay marriage was an equality too far. Even Peter Tatchell thought that was ridiculous. Christina Summers, who is a personal friend of mine, is a Green councillor in Brighton and is about to be expelled because in a public debate she spoke against same-sex marriage. There is a Tory candidate who had the misfortune of once being praised by me. I was so shocked I liked a Tory candidate that I wrote in an article. She wrote me and asked me to remove the article from the web, although it was written 7 years ago, because there were gay rights groups scouring the web, and if they found that she was linked to a noted homophobe like myself, then Conservative Central Office would immediately deselect her. There are so many examples of that kind of thing. Let me finish with this. Speaking of Tatchell, going back to that 2002 article, looking at the birth of the gay liberation movement in the early 1970s, it almost made me want to be gay, actually. It's just such a brilliant article. He said, "There were no calls for equality. Our demand was liberation." I love that. "We wanted to change society, not conform to it." That's where I am at as a Christian. I have to say that. I regard the current direction of our society as not really being for equality, but being fundamentally illiberal and intolerant. I want a society where the Christian values of tolerance, love, compassion, and respect for all are the predominant ethos. I refuse to conform to this brave new world of Cameron, Salmond, and Tatchell. That's why I'm opposed to same-sex marriage, because I am a rebel in the name of love. Thank you.
Well, we're almost on time. This is where we move to the slightly more conversational side of the evening. I'll remind you that our rule is that each of the speakers in order is able to put a question to one of the other panellists, and we'll see where we go from there. So, to begin with, Mr. Rennie, a question.
Well, I'll let you choose which one answers this question. I suppose the central part of this for me is about imposing views. I get the distinct impression that those who are against equal marriage or same-sex marriage want to impose their views on the rest of society, when there is no intention of society or the Parliament to impose views on any churches. But why do you think that's right?